necessary medical examinations. We have 20,000 registered patients, while the real numbers are many times higher. These children need special medical care, and we hope that international organizations will stand by them by providing them with what they need.
The Yemeni Health Ministry has recorded nearly 500 deaths due to the lack of only one of the drugs used to treat thalassemia. The ones grappling with the disease seem to be losing hope as time goes by. With their health constantly deteriorating, they are desperately asking for help from international organizations, including the UN.
We suffer a lot from thalassemia. Medicines are not available. We need expensive medicines such as growth injections. We also suffer from a shortage of blood donors, which is what we need continuously.
We greatly need to be provided with important medicines that have not been available since the beginning of the war, such as iron withdrawal treatments. Because our iron level is high due to frequent blood transfusions, which also causes frequent infections.
Saudi Arabia's siege on Yemen and the ensuing shortages of food and medicine is putting more lives at risk every day. The healthcare system is feeling a massive strain, and the international community has yet to take any definitive steps towards ending the crisis here. Abdul Latif Loshali, Sana'a.
The Italian government has been authorized to send, when it sees fit, military assets, materials and equipment to Ukraine until December 31st next year. The go-ahead has arrived from Italy's lower house, the Chamber of Deputies, which has passed a motion presented by the right-leaning parties backing the government coalition and supported by some opposition groups, including centre-left Democratic Party and centrist Italia Viva Azione. Italy has so far classified the arms it has been sending to Ukraine, but some media have suggested the next package will likely include air and missile defense.
9 months after the start of the conflict, sending weapons to Ukraine is no longer the way to go. We must put peace talks on the table and work all together for a UN-backed peace conference promoted by the EU.
Support for Ukraine has been a contentious issue within the ruling coalition, with Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni positioning herself as a staunch supporter of Kiev. However, her partners Matteo Salvini and Silvio Berlusconi, respectively leaders of the League and Forza Italia parties, have been so far much more ambiguous due to their historical ties with Moscow and President Vladimir Putin. The two have repeatedly stressed the urgency of stepping up efforts to promote peace negotiations.
Giorgia Meloni is firmly and strongly linked or attached to the partnership and the alliance in with the United States and with NATO. So I don't think she will do something to promote compromises or peaceful or diplomatic solution.
NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg has recently said, quote, "The Western alliance intends to keep fighting for Ukraine until it wins back all the territory Russia has seized since 2014. However, there seems to be an open wedge between the parliament and the Italian people. Latest polls show that more than half of Italians advocate for peace negotiations between Russia and Ukraine, and only a third are okay with a country sending more weapons to Kiev.
Peace talks must be started now. They have to find a solution to end this war. This situation is dangerously taking us toward a brink.
We are being run by governments of weaklings in the pocket of NATO, and the Meloni government is no different. Our constitution clearly says Italy rejects war.
It's not anymore a war between Russia and Ukraine. It's about all of us. We begin to feel exhausted.
The approval of the motion in the lower house on supplying weapons to Ukraine also included a provision which increases military spending to 2% of GDP by 2028, as required by NATO. The motion is currently under discussion at the upper house. The Senate will have the final say on the matter. Max Civili, Rome.
Pakistan has hosted a dialogue platform for the OIC member states to boost cooperation among them in the field of science and technology. Senior officials representing Iran, Kazakhstan, Tunisia, Qatar, Malaysia, Indonesia, and Pakistan attended the meeting, while Saudi Arabia, Morocco, Turkey, Azerbaijan, United Arab Emirates, and Cameroon participated via video conference. The first senior officials meeting of the OIC Forum was aimed at strengthening scientific cooperation and to encouraging major technological initiatives.
This forum provides us opportunities of bilateral, multilateral cooperation. So one or two or several countries can work together. With Iran, of course, we have a very strong cultural, historical, and scientific collaboration. And of course, Pakistan and Iran can work together.
Iran's Deputy Science Minister, Peyman Salehi, told the meeting that OIC was established to strengthen unity and collaboration among Islamic countries. He offered the participants Iran's cooperation in the field of science and technology.
This collaboration between 15 countries may have a very fruitful outcome in near future. Therefore, we arranged for the first meeting of ministers that will be held, I think, about 4 to 6 months later.
The Iranian minister further said that despite the sanctions imposed by the West, Iran is self-sufficient in the field of science and technology and has invested big in its infrastructure and commercialization of technology.
In 2021, Iranian scientists published about 78,000 papers, peer-reviewed papers in international journals. And at the moment, we are in the rank 15 in the world. We have established about 50 science and technology parks in Iran, more than 240 incubators, and so on.
Participants in the meeting discussed in detail the objectives, terms of reference, and working procedures of the OIC 15 and recommended them for adoption by the ministerial committee, which is scheduled to be held in the near future.
The presence of Iranian officials in the OIC meeting shows that Iran is not dependent on the East or the West, and it's ready to boost its political and scientific cooperation with various countries across the globe. Nasser Kazmi in Islamabad.
South Korea's container and cement truck drivers are out in the cold on strike with no extension to an agreement they say ensures safe cargo transportation and livable incomes. The union also wants tanker trucks, auto carriers, and delivery vehicles included in their deal. The strike action has widened to Seoul Metro Subway, with other transportation workers also threatening walkouts.
Believing in the government's commitment to the constitution and expansion of the safe freight system, we held off the strike and waited. But the system expires in a month, and the government's promise has not been kept. So we had no choice but to bring out our last card, the strike card.
Slowdown in construction and cargo delivery has already caused hundreds of millions in damages each day, with 5,000 truckers off the job. The slowdowns are rippling through South Korea's export-led economy as the strike enters its second week. President Yoon Suk-yeol this week ordered cement truck drivers back to work, with construction companies reporting losses into the tens of millions of dollars.
The foundation of our industries is in danger of being devastated. Even people's daily lives are being threatened. There is no way to justify the act of taking the lives of people and the national economy hostage to accomplish their own interest.
The Yoon administration has vowed to deal sternly with the illegal strike action.
The truckers were on strike just 5 months ago, but that strike only ended with the extension of the safe trucking freight rate system through the end of this year. With the government's back-to-work order, the truckers are threatened with fines and even jail sentences for those refusing to get back behind the wheel. Frank Smith, Weiwang, South Korea.
Yemen is on the road to achieving self-sufficiency, with government plans and strategies aimed at doubling and expanding Yemeni agriculture and local food production. On this trip to a Yemeni farmland, I am accompanied by Wajih al-Mutawakkil. The man is in charge of vegetable production in Yemen. Al-Mutawakkil is one of the government officials leading the campaign to revive Yemen's rich agriculture. He is here to show us the agricultural projects the government is funding.
We are now on the outskirts of Sana'a, right behind Sana'a International Airport, and beyond this point is where Yemen's agricultural renaissance is beginning to take place. Here, there's farmers that are planting crops such as garlic, onions, barley, and wheat. And these are crops that are vital to keeping the Yemeni economy afloat and keeping Yemenis from going hungry during this strangling economic blockade imposed by Saudi Arabia.
One of the ways to counter food shortage in Yemen is through the launch of water-based greenhouse projects.
These are the greenhouse projects we launched. There are about 8 on this farm. These are water-based greenhouse, which means we plant crops using gravel instead of soil. This gravel is extracted from the Yemeni mountains. This greenhouse project is made up of organic natural materials found only in Yemen.
Outside of these gas houses is an even more vital crop being harvested in acres of land that stretch beyond the horizon. Yemeni wheat. According to the Ministry of Agriculture, Yemen imports an estimated 4 million tons of wheat a year from foreign countries. To achieve self-sufficiency status, Yemen must produce its own wheat in order to eliminate its dependency on foreign imports. Farmers on the outskirts of the Yemeni capital are answering the call to produce more wheat.
This portion of the wheat is ready to be reaped, while the rest of the field is going to take another week to a week and a half before it is ready.
I like to take the wheat and grind it with my hands. Then I blow away the flax, and now it's ready for consumption.
As food production increases, many organizations have been formed to help achieve food security. Huan Foundation for Development in Agriculture is one of them. Huan Foundation educates Yemenis on the importance of helping the advance of the nation through agricultural initiatives. Huan also specializes in the production of basic foods from a combination of Yemeni seeds and grains at their local factory. They have even started their own brand of flour and healthy snacks sold in and out of the country. Huan's president believes that Yemen's high-quality agriculture must be revived in order to provide healthy food options for Yemenis and to eradicate some of the diseases caused by imported foods.
International organizations are playing and have played a large role in destroying Yemeni agriculture. They did so by exporting grain and wheat to us, which is often rotten and contains harmful substances like chemicals. Additionally, these grain shipments that enter Yemen have passed their expiration date, which results in a lot of illnesses.
After the revolution of September 21st in 2014, achieving self-sufficiency in Yemen is no longer an impossible task. According to Yemen's Ministry of Agriculture, if local food production continues to increase, Yemen could reach food security in just a few years.
The revolution against Western hegemony in Yemen was a starting point towards achieving self-sufficiency, which according to the Ansarullah leader is essential in order to secure food provisions for Yemenis. Yusuf Maudi, the outskirts of the Yemeni capital.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Experts in the U.S. have warned that they are deeply concerned that the Biden administration is minimizing COVID at a time when it needs to be redoubling its efforts to ensure funding and resources to prevent another surge. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of Common Dreams wrote, refuting President Joe Biden's recent claim that the pandemic is over, a group of physicians, epidemiologists, and other experts warned in an open letter published recently that COVID-19 remains a deadly and disabling threat, including in the United States of America, which is ill prepared for a possible winter surge fueled by the emergence of new Omicron strains. We know from our clinical and research experience that the pandemic is far from over, and that national efforts to secure the health and well-being of the American public are far from complete, the scholars wrote in the esteemed British Medical Journal, adding, we're deeply concerned that the Biden administration is minimizing COVID at a time when it needs to be redoubling its efforts to ensure funding and resources to prevent another surge. The U.S. hasn't put in the effort needed to move into a new phase with confidence, states the letter, adding, booster coverage even among older Americans is abysmal. With only half of vaccinated adults having received a booster, this places the U.S. 73rd globally for booster coverage. Fewer than 6% of immunocompromised Americans, a group that accounted for nearly 1 in 5 hospital admissions during the BA2 surge, have received Evalshut, a therapy to help prevent COVID-19. To make matters worse, just 4% of eligible Americans have so far received the new bivalent booster tailored to protect against the dominant subvariant. Recent polling found that over half of fully vaccinated adults don't know they are eligible for the shot, and less than 1/3 say they plan to get their fourth vaccine dose as soon as possible. Rampant right-wing anti-science campaigns have played a significant role, to be sure, but so too has the nation's for-profit healthcare model, as well as efforts to normalize the ongoing dangers posed by the continuously mutating coronavirus. Soon after Biden downplayed the pandemic in his 60 Minutes interview, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, announced that masking will no longer be universally required in healthcare facilities and nursing homes. If Biden's recent comment indicates that the administration is positioned to pull back further pandemic mitigation, the public health experts warned recently, the U.S. will be preparing for a major storm without even an umbrella in hand. They wrote, pandemics do not end with a flip of a switch, adding, despite the widespread belief that the pandemic is over, death and disruption continue. As Americans embrace what McKinsey and Company has called individual endemicity, in which people let their risk tolerance dictate the preventive measures they take, transmission rates remain at dangerous levels in nearly every county of the U.S. throughout the summer. The U.S. recorded approximately 3,000 deaths per week, at least the equivalent of a 9/11's worth of deaths each week, and often more. The Delta and Omicron surges took 350,000 American lives in 7 months, almost seven times as many fatalities as claimed by the most severe flu season in years. In early September 2022, COVID-19 was the second leading cause of death in the United States, claiming more lives than stroke and common cancers. Beyond its outsized death toll, COVID-19 is leaving many Americans in diminished health and with less economic security. More than 7% of Americans report experiencing protracted post-COVID symptoms. Recent estimates suggest long COVID has forced at least 500,000 people out of the workplace. The continuing impact of the pandemic is particularly devastating given its unequal burden on communities of color and socioeconomically vulnerable populations, who are less likely to have private insurance to cover prevention, testing, and treatment costs. The U.S. is in a different position than it was when the pandemic first emerged, thanks to the increased availability of vaccines, tests, and treatments made possible by robust funding. But the money underpinning the free provision of those medical tools is rapidly disappearing, leading to what Adam Gaffney, an assistant professor of medicine at Harvard University and pulmonary and intensive care unit doctor, calls the rationing of COVID care by ability to pay. While Biden has repeatedly asked Congress to authorize billions of dollars in additional spending to address COVID-19 and monkeypox, including resources that would be directed toward international efforts, lawmakers led by Senator and the Republicans have refused for months to allocate new money. The president's premature assertion about the end of the pandemic, meanwhile, has only bolstered right-wing demands for austerity, and the continuing resolution passed recently excluded funding for both infectious disease outbreaks. Earlier this year, the White House sounded the alarm about the potential coronavirus surge in the coming month that could infect up to 100 million people nationwide, resulting in a million hospitalizations and nearly 200,000 additional deaths in a worst-case scenario. People in the U.S., already home to more than 1 million of the world's COVID-19 deaths, have died at a significantly higher rate than their counterparts in other wealthy nations. For individual health care, paid sick leave, and other life-saving rights for 1 decade ago. Notably, average life expectancy in the U.S. has declined substantially over the past 2 years. The experts wrote, "We need a full-court press this fall to reverse these trends and reach more of the public with boosters and antivirals." Echoing recommendations made recently by the People's CDC, the letter continues, "The U.S. must make smart investments in the future of our country's response. We need to continue prioritizing tests, masks, treatments, and ventilation. Failing to produce these resources and make them widely accessible will effectively waste the benefits of the scientific advances we have made thus far. Inadequate funding may also slow or stop our progress towards developing new and more protective nasal and pan-coronavirus vaccines and therapies." Globally, the pandemic has caused more than 15 million deaths. People in low-income countries have been deprived of equal access to life-saving COVID-19 medical tools, leaving billions of people in Africa and other parts of the global south completely unprotected. The Lancet's COVID-19 Commission declared last month that widespread failures during the COVID-19 pandemic at multiple levels worldwide have led to millions of preventable deaths and a reversal in progress towards sustainable development for many countries. Starkly unequal access to medicines, fueled by high-income nations, gobbling up disproportionate shares of jobs and therapeutics, and pharmaceutical corporations refusing to share knowledge and technology has contributed massively to avoidable suffering. It also enables the coronavirus to continue circulating and mutating, increasing the likelihood of a vaccine-resistant variant emerging. Lancet, in its recent publication about infectious diseases, wrote, "The best chance to stop this pandemic is to make vaccines available for everyone and everywhere. The efforts to provide booster doses should be balanced with the efforts to attain vaccine equity."
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story. In
what is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Israeli forces have killed a Palestinian during an arrest raid in the occupied West Bank. As bad as that may sound, it falls pale in comparison to the brutality of the Israeli regime's track record recently, which includes killings on a daily basis, one execution style, and another to have killed five in one day. These incidents follow months of tensions that have deepened since Israeli forces began a crackdown in the occupied West Bank back in March in response to a series of attacks by Palestinians inside of Israel. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why Israel has ramped up its spree of killings and whether we are on the cusp of another intifada. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Farah Hughes, journalist, author, and activist, joins us from Belfast. Also joining us is Kevin Barrett, editor at Veterans Today, who joins us from Madison.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Farah Hughes, I'll first start with you, and we'll start with the Gaza Strip. We have had Israel attack the Gaza Strip in overnight strikes against some sites of the Hamas resistance group. It came after a rocket was fired from Gaza, and also at the center of it was two members of the Islamic Jihad who were killed in a raid by the Israeli forces in the West Bank town of Jenin. This obviously comes now with almost a new administration in place, if there is one, that can be efficient in terms of the plight of Palestinians. What do you think about what has occurred?
I just think it's a natural continuation and possible expansion of Israeli Zionist control, genocide, and the fact that they are trying to, force Palestinians to conform to Israeli law. Now, I understand, especially in the West Bank, that Palestinians are treated under military law and the settlers are treated under civilian Israeli law. But it really is a continuation of Israel's past extremist balance. You've already mentioned that, nearly every day we are hearing of unarmed Palestinians being summarily extrajudicially murdered by the Israeli state. We hear about either house demolitions or we hear about houses being sequestered by the Zionist settlers. We have land stolen the Dummins every day, and there appears to be no end in sight. And when I hear of the dawn raids that take place at 20 past four in the morning in and around Jenin and Nablus and Ramallah and Nabi Saleh and Beit Sahur and Bethlehem and any village and any Palestinian homeland or town in the occupied West Bank, I sometimes think this is just Deir Yassin on a slightly smaller scale. If we remember, it was on the 9th of April in 1948, 120 members of three terrorist organizations that were set and designated as terrorists by the British under the British mandate. You had the Irgun, the Lehi, and the Haganah, some of whose members went on to become the Israeli Defense Force. Terrorists in 1948, and somehow they're defending the state in 2022. But those people went in and they murdered between 100 and 250 Palestinian men, women, and children. There are reports that they mutilated the bodies, that an 8-month-old pregnant woman was shot point blank in the belly, that they robbed the dead and they stole things from the houses. And nothing really happens separate to that today. When you hear Palestinians saying that they are all kind of corralled into one room while the IDF illegally, as part of their illegal occupation and oppression of the Palestinian people, search their homes and then people find money missing and jewelry missing. These people, the Palestinians who resist today are the descendants of the victims of 1948, and the Israeli Zionists who oppress those Palestinian descendants today, many of whom are descendants of the Irgun, the Lehi, and the Haganah, who were terrorists. I believe even today the IDF is a terrorist organization, and that while they continue to steal the land, steal the houses, steal the possessions, and steal the very lives of Palestinians, we are just witnessing from the outside an ongoing, continuing genocide.
Let's talk about an incident that happened, Kevin Barrett, where you had a very, very horrific execution-style death of a Palestinian, which happened at point-blank range. This happened about 48 hours ago. And it comes, first of all, I don't know if you've seen that footage or not, and the way that this Palestinian was killed, Kevin Barrett. Give us your reaction to that as to why a police officer would actually, or I'm assuming it's a police officer, maybe it was just a security officer, would do that.
Well, this is completely typical behavior, actually, by Israeli forces, which routinely shoot unarmed Palestinians. So in a sense, it's nothing all that surprising. And the Israelis routinely lie about it and cover up for the killers. And that seems to have happened in this case, where clearly this Palestinian was unarmed, and yet they lied later and tried to make it sound like it was some kind of knife attack. In fact, what had happened was a dispute with...
Yeah, but I'm sorry to jump in, but the thing is, when you look at the footage, you see them scuffling, the security officer and the Palestinian, and then the police officer takes out a gun and shoots him three times, I think, right at point-blank range. And then they're not allowed, they don't allow the ambulances to get to the site of the scene. That's not, I don't know if that's typical, but I don't think it's typical. But my question is, what would motivate, or what would be a reason for a police officer, Israeli police officer, a security officer, to feel that it could do that?
Well, unfortunately, it is somewhat typical in that Israeli forces feel that they have carte blanche to execute Palestinians in cold blood, and they've been doing so essentially, as the other guest correctly said, since 1948, and even longer, actually. If you read Thomas Suarez's book, State of Terrorism, you'll see that these terror groups that later became the IDF were already slaughtering people, including even some Jewish people, and of course, the British, decades before that. So it's true, it's shocking, it's vastly worse than the kinds of things we've seen here in the United States that got the BLM movement going, where Americans get slaughtered by police, but it's vastly worse. In occupied Palestine, it's true that in many cases in the past, it's been done at a longer distance by snipers, which is the more typical way that the Israelis just execute Palestinians with impunity. Sure. But in this particular case, though, I think perhaps they've been emboldened to do more of this and to lie more outrageously about it.
That's it, isn't it? I mean, this is what happened days after when there was a separate incident. You had the Israeli police chief praising officers for killing a Palestinian, which they alleged to have carried out a car ramming attack. And this is what that police officer, or the police chief, I should say, said: "A dead terrorist is what I want to see." So my question is, Frahius, is that then protocol? Is that what they're taught? Is that what they're told to do?
I'm going to say yes, and I'm not going to suggest that they're potentially taught to do that, but I think it would be something that is maybe discussed among the police and discussed among the soldiers and is tacitly accepted by the state and the government when we consider how few soldiers, IDF members, Jerusalem police, etc., border police, have ever been brought to justice for their criminal crimes against the Palestinian people. I have always in my heart seen a parallel, not just between Ireland, where I'm from, and the fate of the Palestinians, but also the state of the American Indians, which perhaps our fellow guests could maybe touch on. And I've always seen a parallel between the Wild West and the Middle East. We had a white European colonization of the Americas, which ended with something like 150 million indigenous people dying. And we have the exact same resume in Israel and Zionism against the indigenous Palestinian population. So in America, once upon a time, they said the only good Indian was a dead Indian. I think we're watching the same parallel, the same consensus, the same dehumanization of the Palestinian indigenous people of the region, the Arab collective in its totality, and the Persians of Iran, all being demonized and all being set under the same kind of headline of the only good Palestinian is a dead Palestinian, the only good Arab is a dead raghead, and the only good Iranian is a dead Persian. And I think that is exactly what is happening. It's what we're witnessing being borne out on the streets. And I think it's an ideology akin to what we saw in the Second World War.
Well, it's not something that, again, this program nor the station is just coming out and presenting out in this particular program here, Kevin Barrett. You have many human rights groups. And this is very telling, I think, and it needs to come out in the open. Many human rights groups are accusing Israel's civilian leadership, according to this one particular source, of the responsibility for transformation of police officers and even of armed civilians into judges and executioners. Human rights groups cumulatively have said that, who slay Palestinians suspected of armed attacks in the streets. So we've reached either this point at some, I don't know when, but it seems like obviously it's been going on for quite some time, in order for human rights groups to come out and make this statement.
Well, that's right. The violence is just over the top, the extremity of it. And now we're reaching the point that the very, very top people in Israel are not only sort of tacitly allowing it and looking the other way, but they're actively encouraging it. Ben-Gavir, this new kingmaker who's joining Bibi Netanyahu for the new Netanyahu regime, he actually called this killer of the most recent killing, of that close-range execution-style murder of that unarmed Palestinian, he called him a national hero. And that's what we've come to expect. And I think the other guest is right. There is a parallel between this kind of extreme bloody-mindedness and just genocidal intent in Israel today and what we saw at some of the worst moments in the genocide of the Native Americans here in the United States. To get a taste of what that was like, I urge people to read Cormac McCarthy's brilliant novel, Blood Meridian, which brings that the worst of that to life and is quite reminiscent of the mentality of the Zionists. And I also think the other guest in talking about this being a genocide, that is, Professor Francis Boyle has written a very clearly reasoned argument according to which, under international law, what's being done to the Palestinians does constitute a genocide. So now they seem to be ramping up this long-term slow-motion genocide, and they have Ben-Gavir actually coming into the government on this platform of endorsing expelling or murdering all Palestinians. And he's right. a worshiper of Baruch Goldstein, the terrorist who slaughtered about 30 Palestinian worshipers at prayer in the Hebron massacre. Mm-hmm. And this guy, Ben-Gavir, had his poster up in his house, and he basically honors that kind of guy. So Israel is completely going insane, and even its strongest supporters in the United States, like Thomas Friedman of the New York Times, are now starting to admit it.
Well, I'm so glad, first of all, that you mentioned Ben-Gavir. Let's break open his personality here, Fra Hughes. He actually poured fuel on the violence that occurred in the occupied West Bank. Not the violence, the incident that happened in the occupied West Bank where you had the double bombing that took place on the bus stops. He came out and he said that he is calling for the extrajudicial execution of Palestinian resistance leaders when that happens. I mean, this guy is supposed to be the incoming national security minister in Israel, and he's calling for the execution of Palestinians. He is so bad of a character that members of the Biden administration have signaled they're not going to engage with him. So that shows how bad this guy is. And of course, he's pro-settler, and he's I don't want to use the word extreme because he goes even beyond that word. Is this system by design? Because it's supposedly because Netanyahu needed his coalition in order to obviously have a majority.
Okay, well, I think what we could do is break that down into two or three separate component parts. I mean, supposedly when Israel, which I do not believe has a legitimate right to exist because it was built on terrorism and the murder of the indigenous Palestinians. That said, the original people involved in the likes of the Irgun and potentially the fledgling IDF were politically to the left. They were not Zionists by religion. They were Zionists by politics. Many of them were atheists and non-religious. So if you look at the transformation of not just progressive, and they're not progressive, but, you know, the government after government after government from 1948 onwards, we have witnessed a slow trajectory move to the right all the way through, which ended up bringing us the likes of Netanyahu, who instead of being impeached in government is now going on to form the new government within the Zionist state. So the settler movement is very much a religious movement and very much believes that every inch of land of Palestine was given to them by God as expressed in the Torah or whatever kind of biblical fantasy that they choose to believe in. So what we've witnessed is this slow encroachment to the right, bit by bit by bit by bit, to the point where we have something like, I don't know, is it slightly less than a million illegal settlers, like 4.2 million Palestinians in the West Bank, but nearly 1 million settlers in the West Bank. Okay. These people are all armed. I've seen them with their AR-15 rifles walking around Jerusalem. I think what we're witnessing is the final solution, and the final solution is to put the Palestinians out of the West Bank and steal as much land and water resources as the Zionists possibly can.
Well, this is something that's very interesting here, Kevin Barrett, and we need to also cover this, and that's about this so-called normalization that has happened between the Persian Gulf Arab leaders and Israel. There was an event that was held in Al-Quds, of which the UAE ambassador was present at that event, and he had Ben-Gvir, who was also there, and they were seen shaking hands, making goodwill gestures towards each other, and at that event, Ben-Gvir comes out and says something that he's very proud of, and that is the fact that he has made peace with Arab states without making any concessions. Now, if I'm the UAE ambassador, I'm wondering, wait a minute, what is he saying, unless he knows? And second of all, if I'm a Palestinian and I read that, then obviously it shows how Palestinians have been robbed by their leaders.
Indeed. Well, it's kind of astounding that the UAE leader would be meeting with Ben-Gvir, who is on the record as being a rabid anti-Arab racist who basically feels that the only good Arab is a dead Arab. And the UAE, these people are Arabs. They speak Arabic. So that's kind of bizarre. That's like a, you know, an African-American leader meeting with somebody who wants to exterminate all the black people. It's just kind of boggles the mind. But it does illustrate the fact that there's a huge gap between the sold-out element among these Gulf oil states that have made this deal with the Zionist regime and the people of the region and the Arab world who do not agree with this. And that's absolutely clear at the World Cup, where people from and Qatar and which also same deal with the Zionists and other Arab world, declare that they have nothing to do with the Zionist entity, that they don't believe it's legitimate. They refuse to talk to the Zionist journalists. And even Newsweek magazine, a pro-Zionist mainstream American publication, just came out with a pretty good, accurate article on this, how the winner of the World Cup is Palestine, because nobody at the World Cup accepts the legitimacy of the Zionist entity, and they've made it absolutely clear. And yet these crazy leaders, like of the Emirates and these other countries, keep pretending that the Zionist regime is okay and meeting with even the worst of their leaders, like Ben-Gvir. So that split between the people of the region and the leadership is ultimately going to a much more open and intense conflict.
Well, you mentioned that, and it's a great thing that you did, because obviously we're in the latter half of the World Cup, but it was very evident, based on the different instances there, Frahis, that the Arab citizens know that there's no legitimacy to be held when it comes to Israel. So can you give us a little bit more about how this divergence, not divergence, but this distance that exists between their leaders and their viewpoint, what is that a reflection of? And I guess the bigger question is, what did these Arab leaders gain from the so-called normalization, if it appears that Israel has made out the most, so to speak, of this so-called normalization?
Okay, well, firstly, the only people who make anything, any traction or any kind of political progress from the normalization is Israel. Israel seeks legitimacy within the region. Israel seeks to be able to allow its citizens to go to Saudi Arabia on holiday, to go to Morocco on holiday, to go to Egypt on holiday, to feel that they are accepted outside of the occupation areas. But we've always seen that the only people who have stood by the people of Palestine are the Syrian Arab Republic, the Republic of Iran, and the people of Yemen, Colonel Gaddafi, and several others. So what we witness when we see the normalization and the gulf that you've talked about or alluded to between the people and the governments, that gulf is all over the world. Many people in Ireland support the right for justice, dignity, and self-determination for the Palestinian people on either a two-state solution or a one-state solution where it's called Palestine and people are treated with equality underneath the law. But that's not the view of the Irish government. That's not the view of the British government. That's not the view of the American government. That's not the view of Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, and other Gulf nations who are beholden to, or were until very recently, beholden to the American and British administrations. Mm. And these people sometimes think my enemy's enemy is my friend. So,
okay.
You know, if you're against Iran, the same as Israel is, then you're in favor of normalization.
Last question goes to you, Kevin Barrett. Top military intel officer in Israel has said that the occupied West Bank violence is only going to get worse. Quote, Israel was not merely facing a wave of terror, as many officials have described it. They describe it that way. But that these young Palestinians' anger is fueling their energy, of which it's faltering in terms of Israel's security apparatus. Are we looking at this getting worse, and to the degree where an intifada may take place? In less than a minute, please.
Yes, I think we are. Obviously, there are very good reasons for the Palestinians to be especially angry right now, with this genocidal Ben-Gavir joining the new Netanyahu government, and with this upswing of these slaughters of Palestinians. These are provocations. It's as if the Zionists are deliberately willing to up the ante, and they're provoking intifada, and they kind of have the tiger by the tail because they can't stop that intifada. They can't really win militarily, and they can't go and execute all the Palestinians the way Ben-Gavir would like. And ultimately, there are a whole lot of rockets behind with Hezbollah, the Islamic Republic of Iran, have their back, that a genocide is not possible, but that's what the new Israeli regime is devoted to. So something has to break here, and we'll see what it is.
Thank you very much for that, Kevin Barrett, editor at Veterans Today from Madison Frah Hughes. Pleasure, journalist, author, and activist from Belfast. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Batavoy and the team, it's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.